this day in 1991, English group Massive Attack released their debut album, Blue Lines. Massive Attack founding member Daddy G was, this is what he said about making the album: "We were lazy Bristol twats. It was Nina Cherry who kicked our butts and got us into the studio. We recorded a lot in Nina Cherry's house, in her baby's room. I was still DJing, but what we were trying to do was create dance music for the head rather than the feet. It was a hugely acclaimed and highly influential album, described as a record that transcended every boundary, and it set the tone for a number of trip-hop, dub and electro acts to follow. For example, Porter's Head's Dummy in 1994 and Tricky's Max and Quay, both of whom, like Massive Attack, came out of the highly creative Bristol scene. And a couple of years ago, band member Robert Del Nanja, or 3D, announced that Massive Attack partnered with a research centre based at the University of Manchester to explore music industry climate impacts. So, an incredible group, really. Anna Dean...
He's also one of those guys who was rumoured to be Banksy, right?
Yes, rumoured to be Banksy, but I don't think he is. He is... Banksy's one of Banksy's closest friends because 3D was also in fact, the pioneer of graffiti stencil art.
Okay.
So they're saying that Banksy perhaps learned off him. Great album, isn't it, Anna?
Fantastic. Absolutely. Mm. Love that sound. Yeah.
You know that, know this album, Tim?
Too old, mate.
Too old?
No.
Right.
Great.
Okay. It's 25 to 5. I just want to come back to that small talk a bit, and if you could just give us an example. You're at a, because this is a real issue for a lot of people. People get quite fearful of going to a function or a party. You've had a bit of experience of it in your line of work. Hmm. The person's there in the corner who you're going to be introduced to, you don't know them. What does one say?
I was just reflecting on this. It's interesting because I definitely think that having a background in retail and also hospitality really teaches people how to cut through that ice. It's a little bit difficult if you're in a room of suits, obviously.
Right.
But what I generally tend to do if somebody is like that, I find an item of clothing, maybe it's a snazzy tie, whatever it is that stands out, I make a comment on it, ask them something about it and follow it up with a memory of my own that's kind of related. And, you know,
that's gold.
Yeah, that's just
gold.
Kind of a little in it. It disarms. It's something that pulls something out. Probably the worst way, I think, to start a conversation would be to ask someone what their favourite music genre is or something like that.
Because either you get a 20-minute lecture or you just get a blank stare or, yeah.
Yeah. But I do find, yeah, item of clothing, snazzy haircut, piece of jewellery.
And that's quite good because you've got praise, question, and because there's implied praise if you're actually picking up on something that they've done. And you may well have thought, oh, yeah, well, actually, you know, I just bought this for the whatever.
Yes.
And then you've got a question and then you've got that you're contributing to it. So
absolutely.
Boom, boom, boom.
Because yeah, flattery, then an anecdote.
This is quite a big deal for a lot of people. So you go up, nice brooch. Is that... I'm not good at this, am I?
No, I really, really was. Have you ever thought maybe radio's not your thing?
All right. 25 to 5, the panel.
I find that I'm getting worse as I get older.
Right.
I don't know if that's... Do you?
I used to be
better at
maybe
small talk.
Maybe you were a lot more open-minded when you were younger and you're more clipped and succinct when you go to a function today.
What are you saying, Wallace?
I'm not saying anything.
Closed-minded now?
No, not at all. Anyway, yesterday we discussed bank closures in rural communities and regional centres and their replacements with smart hubs. Well, National MP Andrew Bailey has called for an inquiry into how bank closures and the ditching of cheques have made it harder for vulnerable communities to manage their finances. This came after Andrew Bailey heard about a pokekohe man with dyslexia, too scared to use internet banking, and was told by his bank to drive to another town to see a teller about 90 kilometres away. The big banks are phasing out cheques, and Kiwi Bank has already done it. So with us is Guy Pope Mail, who's the chairman of the Dyslexia Society. Guy, welcome to the panel.
Good afternoon.
So, okay, we've got to have a bit of a scratchy line there, Guy. You're still with us?
Sorry?
Yep.
Yes, I'm still with you.
You have real issues with both bank closures and the ending of the chequebook. Explain the issue as you see it.
Okay, well, first of all, I'm neurotypical. I'm not dyslexic, okay? So I prefer to use the left-hand side of my brain. It's good for executive function. And so I actually love internet banking. But the fact is that for those that are neurodiverse, let's say dyslexic and possibly also autistic or dysgraphia or dyscalculia, they love to use the right-hand side of their brain. They're creative, they're big-picture thinkers, they're problem solvers. And when it comes to internet banking, the likes of myself has to just concentrate, somebody who's dyslexic is really concerned and fearful of transposing numbers or getting things wrong. And as a consequence, they just it's just not a pleasant experience.
And you do say that around 1 million people were neurodifferent in ways, who do find internet banking stressful. Can you explain a bit more about why internet banking in particular is stressful?
I think the thing is that the whole process of going online, putting in bank account numbers, putting in the numbers for the amount that you're sending somebody, that whole process is just a process that doesn't feel comfortable. It's using the side of the brain that they prefer, that they don't like to use, and as a consequence, they have to like triple check the numbers, maybe have somebody else come over and check that they've done it correctly. And of course, I'm not talking about all people who are dyslexic. It's a personal thing.
Yes.
But as a general rule, this is the case.
Is there a solution in phone banking? My mother is not a fan of internet banking. She's an older woman. She is afraid of making mistakes, doesn't like to do it. So she relies heavily on phone banking, so can at least do it personally. Is that a solution or is it still an issue?
Well, I think the same thing applies. You've got to, again, apply that executive function side of your brain in order to go through the motions and get that right. I mean, the reality is that people who are neurodiverse generally prefer to deal with things face to face.
Right.
At the end of the day, there's a bit of an irony here too, because it might be, in fact, that banks haven't considered their digital interface specifically with dyslexic people in mind. Mm. Maybe it could be improved, but that's the kind of lens that needs to be brought to the situation for sure.
Anna, you got a question or thoughts?
No, it's just, I've moved somewhere, I'm living in Golden Bay now, and there's no bank branch where I'm living,
yes.
And I have to travel to Nelson to visit my bank, and it's been quite an eye-opener, actually. You know, people who are living in main centres just don't know the difference between that convenience, so if there's this double barrier, especially in areas of low connectivity as well, I can see that it's a real problem.
Of what Golden Bay has?
On my phone it does, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
This is nothing. I mean, I remember writing stories literally more than 20 years ago when we were first talking about automating banking, even when they were putting ATMs into towns and saying, oh, well, the branches will be closing. And there was real concern from Grey Power and various organisations then saying that, you know, this would be coming and it would be a concern. Now, it's taken a long time, but I just dug up before we came in here. Kiwi Bank was supposed to be part of the solution to this. Mm-hmm. I'm saying Jim Anderton, back in 2000, when he was kicking it off, I've got a quote from a speech here. He says, over the time, the number of Kiwi Bank outlets will obviously grow. That is one reason why a Kiwi Bank is better than the existing banks, which only seem to be interested in closing branches. That was part of the argument for Kiwi Bank, and I do wonder whether there's a, you know, okay. as the government's bank, there should be some more social
but
obligation.
But here's the thing, folks, and here's the deal, Guy. 99% of us do not use cheques. That's just the reality, right? And for one cheque, it costs $12 to process. I put it to you that it's just not worth it.
Well, I think if you look at...
Guy, are you there?
I'm just saying, if you use it as an example... putting ramps into buildings to make sure that people in wheelchairs can gain access. There's a huge amount of cost in making sure that buildings are accessible to people with physical disability, and we don't ever question that. And I think the same thing applies here. That kind of logic just makes the vulnerable very marginalised and makes their situation a lot worse. I mean, I think to be fair, society and also government is moving towards inclusion and removing barriers. In fact, there's an accessible Aotearoa Act in the pipeline, which is before Cabinet in May, which is all about removing barriers. And yet here we've got, with cheques and branches, we're creating barriers. So I think you know, this is a big agenda of change across society about recognizing very real barriers for people with different ways of thinking, with temporary impairment, and what we can do about it.
All right, thank you very much, Guy. I appreciate your thoughts on that. Guy Pope Mail there, the chairman of the Dyslexia Society. Someone says, I just opened internet banking. It took about 6 weeks. I can barely read the numbers on the screen, and it's a daunting process to make sure I get it right. So
I think he's made some good points.
Yeah, some valid points there, eh? And look, a bit on small talk, and I want to read this out because this is fascinating. A wedding photographer says, small talk is the number one human skill. I'm a wedding photographer, and I spend my life meeting strangers and gaining access to their world. The best tip, just pay attention to the other person. Forget you and be interested in them. An item of clothing, as Anna said, what they do, how they hold themselves. Just ask and be genuinely interested and they'll welcome you like an old friend. And once you stop talking and start listening, you'll be amazed at how fantastic people are. That is the message of the day. I love that. Thank you for that. And Justin and Kerikeri says, well, this is what I do. The Queen's standard question, have you come far?
Hey, well, she would be the...
She's a pro.
...expert of this stuff, right? Pro.
Have you come far? 15-5. The housing crisis shows no sign of abating as prices continue to rise. It's been suggested that investing in shares is perhaps a better way to go if you want to get yourself financially sorted. Financial journalist Francis Cook, who's behind the podcast Cooking the Books, has written a column in the New Zealand Herald saying buying a house is not a ticket to financial security. And Francis is with us now to explain. Francis Cook, kia ora.
Kia ora.
Yeah, good to have you on. Interesting opinion piece here. So you're saying that actually... if you look at it, investing in shares is smarter, perhaps, than financially buying a house.
Yeah, I mean, if I had to choose between the two, I would pick shares every time. And I don't mean to diminish how people are feeling if they're a first home buyer that really wants to buy that first house. I get that, and buying a home has all sorts of benefits. But truly, if I had to pick, I would pick shares every time, because having that money coming in gives you so many more options than having just a paid off house, as wonderful as that is. And you can also get started right now. You don't have to build up that $100,000, $200,000 deposit. You can start with $5, and time is often the biggest factor for being successful with your money.
Let's jump straight into our panellists, because I think Anna Dean, have you not just very, very recently bought a house?
Yes, I have, actually, in October. And this kind of conversation gives me the heebie-jeebies, to be honest. Hi, Francis.
Hello.
Yeah, it's such a conundrum, and it's so fraught. And having been on the other side and wanting my first house for so, so, so long, house sitting for an entire year to be able to save more for a deposit, it's a really tricky, emotionally loaded scenario. Yeah. And I guess my question for you, Francis, is do you own your own house?
Yeah, I do. And I am very lucky to be speaking from that position of being privileged enough to own my own house.
Yeah, because it's interesting, because I definitely think that if perhaps you didn't, I mean, it'd be interesting to compare if you didn't have a house, would you be recommending that? I mean, personally, I invested in shares for 5 years. The amount I put in was exactly the same as I got out. So I, 5 years later, so I got a little bit burnt in terms of my expectations around shares, and that was a managed fund. So it's a tricky one. And my other question I had was, have you ever lived through a major share crash?
Well, last year.
Oh, yeah.
We saw biggest, I think it was the biggest Wall Street crash that we've seen outside of wartime. So that
rebounded rather well, though.
Very well.
It did. And this is what shares do, to be honest. Usually it's not that quick. I mean, full disclosure, it's not that quick usually. But this is what shares do. They talk about it goes up an escalator and down in the lift. The down feels horrible. But shares still go up on average 7 out of every 10 years, you know, and even when you take those dips in.
Can you tell me which 7 years?
Yeah.
Yeah. If I could, I wouldn't be talking to you. I'd be on a beat somewhere. But, you know, nobody can. And that's, I think, the thing with shares is getting started early and sticking in it is one of the biggest things. And I totally hear you on, or, you know, people get in and they give it a couple of years or 5 years like you did, and they feel like they didn't get ahead. Mm. And shares are a long-term game. That usually they say sort of 5 to 10 years is the minimum amount of time to give it, because you might hit one of those catastrophic dips, and the biggest thing there is to ride it out. Mm. So you need to give it the time to bounce back and then get those amazing, shocking good years that then bounce it out. We talk about, you know, shares on average actually grow more in value than a house does. And that's been the case in New Zealand as well as all over the rest of the world.
That's not often it's well understood, is it, Frances? Because I know that Mary Holm has said something similar to that, as well as Shanvil Jakob, that the yield of the house is, what is it, about 5 to 6%. But sometimes, I mean, you can have an investment portfolio, a growth fund. It can be quite high in the sort of double digits.
Oh, exactly, absolutely. I mean, they say on average 7% a year, but that's going to take years where 20% 1 year, -5% another year, and that's why you have to sit in there for quite a while. And that's why, you know, if you're young and broke and feeling locked out of the housing market, that actually shares a fabulous view, because you don't need all that much money. $5 a week can get you into it. It's time. And if you're young and broke and have oodles of time up your sleeve, you can make so much more money with so little effort just by leaving it alone.
Tim? By leaving it alone. Yeah, I mean, and look, there was a lot of reportage last year, wasn't there, Frances, that you know, sharesies obviously took off during lockdown. People had time and were not spending, and there was a huge burst. Do you know if that's continued through? Are people still investing? Because there definitely was a big uptick last year in share investment.
Yeah, it was massive. And I think this is the thing, is there was suddenly a lot of people with time on their hands that started listening to podcasts like mine, or they read a couple of books and thought, right, everything is terrifying right now with money and we're going to get into it. And the FMA, the Financial Markets Authority, actually released some figures that showed, I believe it was the number of people on those do-it-yourself platforms, the Sharesies, Hatch, InvestNow places, they doubled over that period of time, which is huge. And it was a lot of really young people getting into things for the first time. And I got to tell you, even looking at my own podcast numbers, I've seen huge growth, and it's stuck around. People now want to know about it.
Quite a bit of response here. Someone says, well, you can't live in a share. This year alone, I'll give my landlord 26...
What's Phil Twyford doing listening to this?
This year alone, I'll give my landlord 26K in rent. Another one says here, sold a house in 2017, bought shares with half of it. I'm up over 10 times, not managed funds, selected the companies myself. I quit my job last year.
Wow.
So
I think
I'd
be careful. This does not count as advice.
This does not count as advice.
Financial
no.
advice. Look, I, because Frances, you said in your column, you know, you can't sell off a square meter of your front lawn and take your kids to the zoo or so forth. But I think that's a good point they make about, you know, rent and so forth. You can't live in a share. And there is something about actually, if you're investing your money, at least with a house, you are not paying another cost. You actually have some security in one of those basic staples of life of, you know, food and shelter. You actually get your shelter. And there is that sense of belonging to, you know, the homeowning democracy that still matters. And I think in a way that shares don't you think?
Yeah, I think there's a really big emotional connection to owning a house. And to be clear, in an ideal world, we all own our own house, we've paid it off, and we've got some shares. But truly, if I had to choose, I'd pick shares. Because the thing about paying off the house is, even once you've paid off the mortgage, it's actually still not free. It's still costing you. You've got to have rates, your maintenance, your insurance. So you're still paying for those, and you've still got to have things like paying for your food, keeping the lights on. Whereas shares will have that money coming in fairly regularly. You can choose sort of where you're investing to get more or less amounts of money coming in day to day. And then that can mean, if you've been investing since you were in your 20s or 30s, then you can strategically do this so that you would have enough money to cover rent and those things like the food, some of the little niceties of life. And it gives you options, you know? I mean, having your own home paid off, security, no landlord, being weird. I mean, yeah, that's fabulous. But having money, if you have to pick, having the money will give you the options and you can pay your rent plus some.
Very, very interesting, Frances. Thank you so much for that. That is financial journalist Frances Cook, who is behind the podcast Cooking the Books. And again, just to reiterate Tim's point, it certainly wasn't a financial advice. It's an opinion piece, and it's a very good one. So I recommend you check it out. But look, you really worked hard, didn't you, Anna? Like a lot of people listen to this, to get into your own home. And you said at the start of the show you couldn't buy in the main centre. You chose a small place. You've got a beautiful little cottage now. On a personal note, you just must be wrapped after years of trying to get in a home, just having one.
Absolutely. I mean, it's been such a battle with these rising house prices, not being able to save fast enough. And right. To be honest, I know how many people there are out there who are, you know, who lie awake at night, who are paying ridiculous amounts in rent, who are constantly moved on. You know, there's something about that own security, particularly if you've got children who don't want to change schools and things like that. It's a tricky, it's a very tricky issue, I think. And people who don't own their own home are in a stressed out state in this
can
country.
Be precarious, yeah. I must admit. I think I'd still choose my home over any shares.
Yeah, and I think that
for
people,
all the other social values you get along with.
I think it's very easy for people who have their own home to actually forget what it feels like to not.
And the problem is that for so many young people today, actually, neither of those is an option. Actually,
absolutely.
I mean, you know, yes, I mean, that's not entirely true. Frances is right. If you can chip in $5 here and little bits of, and pieces here. So there is often an option at a very entry level with shares, but which is you couldn't have a few years ago. But it's still, for most people, there's really... You know, that's a very wonderful choice
now,
to be able to have.
Finally, I wanted to raise this. I found this fascinating. This is from a business reporter, Daniel Ziffer from ABC News Australia, who writes that the compulsion to answer calls, texts and emails out of hours has been rejected with a new power, the right to disconnect. And he dubs it the digital leash. Now, unions in Australia are pushing to give workers the legal right to ignore non-emergency calls from work. Victoria police staff have won the right to disconnect. So with us is Barbara Bucket, an employment lawyer at Bucket Law. Barbara, kia ora.
Kia ora, Simon.
As a principle, what do you make of the right to disconnect?
Well, it's not unfettered and you can push back. I think the answer lies in the Employment Relations Act. In New Zealand, we've got obligations to specify in your contract, your employment contract, agreed hours of work, and that must include the start and finish times of work, and it must also refer to any flexibility in the matters referred to in relation to hours of work. So I think that's the first thing that you, and then most contracts then talk about reasonable hours. So if you're being asked, if you're on this digital leash, it's not unfettered. You've got a right to say this is not reasonable. And then, of course, if you're working long hours and it's a health and safety issue, I suspect that that's another reason why you could push back on it. So I don't think it's... I think in New Zealand we've got some fallback. But I guess it's really what's happened is the boundaries have been blurred, haven't they, really, because everybody's sort of gone along with this.
You agree with that, Anna?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And you've noticed this?
Oh, definitely. And anyone who owns their own business will be well aware of this. Plus, we have this smartphone technology that means that we are contactable 24 hours a day. It's just the age now in which we all live. So I think setting boundaries is an incredibly important way to keep our workforce actually sane and high functioning.
Tim, you got a thought for Barbara here?
Sorry, Wallace, what was that? I was just on my phone.
Scrolling.
So many things to do. No, look, there is a balance in there somewhere, right? I think there we live in a very flexible world, and yes, we have technology now that demands stuff of us. Sometimes I find it less stressful to be able to actually stay on that leash a little bit longer when it suits me. Sometimes you know people saying, look, you know, we won't contact you after hours. I was like, actually, I'd rather wrap this up today and get this done. You know, there can be different approaches to that. But look, and at the other end, you know, I think we have to be realistic about the workloads that are expected these days.
Yes.
You know, there is a big. I like the fact that there's a pushback on well-being and people are actually saying,
so just finally
enough.
On that, in Aotearoa, Barbara, we do have, or peer employees do have a right to push back.
Oh, I think so, and it's also a right to switch off. I'd put it the other way around. Okay. I think is that right, and I think you can push back if these things aren't unreasonable, but go back to the contract. But it's got to be made clear. I think everybody has, and everybody's got a responsibility to make sure those boundaries are well marked out, and work-life balance and flexible working hours are respected.
Okay. Barbara, thanks for your time there. Barbara Bucket, the employment lawyer at Bucket Law there. Final thought, Hannah?
I was just going to say, one thing I've been noticing is people taking their work email off their phone. Yeah, that's definitely something. And then also setting out of office responses that I don't answer emails after 5 p.m. or 7 p.m.
Yep,
and things like that.
I think there's definitely some of that pushback happening.
All right. Yeah. Home to play with the Toro for me. Tim Locke and Anna Dean, you've both been fantastic today. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Wallace.
I'm Wallace Chapman. See you tomorrow for Friday's show, 3:45 sharp. Till then, bye.